Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another video. I'm here again with Todd Lewis. So last time I had Todd on, he was espousing an energy-based economics. Now he wants to talk about what he's calling the physics of peace, and we'll get to what that means in a second. Before we get there, Todd, how can people find you?
You can find me at PLF Podcast on X, and you can type in YouTube, Praise of Fly Podcast.
I will just remind people, you can pick up a course at the Academic Agency. And at the end, I'll be playing the Eric Kaufman ad again for his new course at the University of Buckingham, which I'm a kind of part of his outfit there as a senior fellow. But let's now talk about the physics of peace. You've subtitled this, You Will Be Compelled to Be Friendly. Once again, Todd, I don't know if the actual title will be that, because the algorithm is a fickle beast, as you well know, running a YouTube channel. And so I have to try to calculate the ideal level of slop clickbait to actually get people to watch the bloody video. This is the game we're all forced to play by evil YouTube in this day and age. But okay, physics of peace, take it away.
And the title was certainly inspired by Adam Curtis, where he has an episode called Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. Yeah, something a little bit like that. So what does all this mean? This is part of a broader reframing that I'm working on my channel and also just personally, of recasting things in terms of physics. Why physics? Well, because within the material sciences, we have three domains, physics, chemistry, and biology. But physics is the most fundamental. Right. You might have biochemistry, which so chemistry and biology coming together. But biochemistry sits on top of thermodynamics, which is physics. So physics is the most fundamental of all the sciences. And it also seeks to describe the physical world that we live in a way that is simple. Now, obviously, the equations that go into that explanation are not simple, but it creates a simple use. And so hearkening back to the golden age of science fiction, now, what happens if you were to intentionally build a society in the light of this scientific knowledge, right? And one of the things that, and they've often been called utopian for this, is that many hoped or predicted that this would lead to a more peaceful society, one in which, you know, we don't have as much of the wars that, you know, were raging at the time in Europe during this period of, you know, and then, or immediately after, right? So sci-fi gets started in the 30s and 40s, there's wars in Europe, and then 60s and 70s, the war's over, but the Cold War's raging. And so the question is, okay, these high-minded goals often get these people, you know, labeled as utopians. But I think that's unfair. I think ultimately what they were trying to do was looking at the world and say, if we understand how physics works and apply it to society and the world, then we will have a better understanding of how to deal with these things. So how does this deal with international relations? How does this deal with war and peace? So if we use Taner's conception of collapse, so you move from a high energy state to a low energy state, you have two types of activities. All human action can be reduced to two types, what we call those that are feng shui and those that are entropic. Feng shui human actions are those actions that either through intuition and or scientific application, you are doing actions that are aligned with maintaining a balance, a surplus of Eroi, right? So not just in your business life, but what you do every single day. And then entropic actions are actions that bring you closer. So if you stay above Eroi greater than one, that's a feng shui action. An entropic action brings you to the point where you get to that point or fall below. Warfare is the most entropic thing that man can do. And so when a civilization needs resources, energy resources, either to forestall collapse or to claw itself out of collapse. This is why you have the paradox of a weaker nation launching a war of aggression, because they think that they need the energy and they need it more acutely. So like Japan in 1941 than the US does. And so they then attack. But of course, that's an entropic action, which of course, if it works, I suppose you get to buy more time. You get to add more time to your clock. But that's still, your clock is still running out. And oftentimes it just accelerates that fact. So ultimately, whether you're, you know, Genghis Khan riding the horde or the East India Company, there's an invisible hand of thermodynamics that will check the expansion of any growing system. I'll call it Selden's Dead Hand, named after Harry Selden from the Foundation series. That will stop you. Now, that's the dynamic system in which all human action is occurring. Now, the current level of development of international institutions for a security architecture that we have currently is not intentionally derived from these principles. So, for example, the Mongols had a limit demarcated how far they could go. And that wasn't the result of a pope or a prince or a UN or anybody. It was physics. The thermodynamics kicked in and that was the limit, right? Now, if you were to build international institutions along these principles with this broader understanding, I believe you could have a international order more in line with what maybe the idealistic 60s liberals thought, like the JFKs of the world. And one of the reasons why we haven't had this is because we haven't had the scientific application that a lot of these science fiction greats from the beginning, like Asimov and Clark, were considering.
There's so many different questions I can ask you here. Let's go in with the most difficult line of attack here, okay, that I can imagine people in the audience may come with. And I'm not intentionally, what I'm doing, Todd, is stress testing these ideas, okay? I'm not trying to tear them down. I'm just trying to come up with steel man counters to make this interesting. Lots of people watching this, maybe people who've read things like Julius Evola's Metaphysics of War, or Ernst Jünger, or who have, deeply into their history, into all the history of the world, will say the trouble is that the human being is the warlike animal, and that the mother of all invention and the mother of all civilization is war, first and foremost. So therefore, the 60s dream of the Jerry Anderson. Is he the right guy? Who was the guy who made Star Wars? Star Trek, I mean.
Gene Roddenberry,
okay. Anderson, I think, was Thunderbirds. But yeah, it was in the ether. All these people, like JFK and so on, they had a view of the world that did not take into account human nature itself. So if physics presupposes all other things, then clearly physics has presupposed that the human being is always going to be the warlike animal. How do you get around this problem? Because you're up against, the tech itself that you're dealing with, the hardware that you've got, human beings want to fight. And they, not only do they want to fight, they derive meaning and purpose and heroism and all sorts of other things, inspiration from killing each other. So this is the hardest kind of counter I can come up with here.
Yeah. Well, and ultimately, I've heard variations of this from a more normal conservative background that, people are going to be the point of failure. People aren't going to want to go along with this, right? And people are going to the arms limitation treaties of the 20s and 30s, people saying, well, that was naive, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so let's step back first and sort of explain what is going on here. So we can view warfare occurring at what broadly four levels, right? We have what we call the forever war, which is the war that the United States keeps stimulating for its business interests. And to be fair, other nations too. And then we have large-scale industrial war, which begins, say, the U.S. Civil War. And then we have, before that, large-scale pre-industrial war. It'd be like Rome versus Carthage. And then we have small-scale pre-industrial war, and let's call that the Norman invasion of England. Now, when you say we want to reduce war or eliminate war, in the year 1750, there were no large-scale industrial wars, lack of material conditions, and there were no forever wars, also lack of material conditions. So at one point in human history, those two kinds of conflicts didn't exist. And what I'm saying is these two kinds of conflicts could also be effectively eliminated in the future by understanding what causes them. And what causes them is not human nature, It is industrial production coupled with the capitalist system, right? The war, the merchants of death was a term that was used commonly in the 20s and 30s to describe the arms manufacturers who sold weapons, often to countries that were going to invade their own country of origin. Hey, it's just business, you know, don't take it seriously. And so they keep artificially stimulating the war. You're not going to produce weapons if no one's going to buy them. And of course, if you supply weapons to the government, you make a lot of money. And so these large-scale modern conflicts that just never seem to end grind on and on, like Indochina in the 40s to the 80s, and then Afghanistan from the 70s to the 2020s. It's because there's all these inputs coming in. You have these inputs of large-scale industrial military activity, which is the result of the merchants of death. Now, currently, you have the communist countries, which then have a totally different system of production, but they have their own incentive to mass produce. Now, all of this is energy inefficient. This is why, for example, how does this theory describe what we see? Well, in the 7th century, the Eastern Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire fought to a standstill. They were both exhausted, and then they were defeated by the Saracens. So what ends up happening here is that war is highly entropic, leaving both parties weaker and more vulnerable to the Saracens than if they had not fought the war in the first place. And so this already existing infrastructure, architecture of physics governing energy flows, which governs human action, which governs war, is there whether we want it to be there or not. It's not like the UN where you have to construct it. It's already there. The UN is constructed, and I would argue that for best results, it should seek to more closely align to that. Problem is, nobody's really measuring it, so we only know about it in general abstractions, much like the Chinese understood qi as energy flows, but not something scientifically precise or measurable. And then second of all, how does this help us then derive a system of international relations that's, you know, reduces these kinds of conflicts? Well, one of the things it would do is it would shift our focus, right? It would shift our focus to the inputs and outputs of what causes a war. So if you were to have all the big U.S. arms manufacturers go out of business tomorrow, the forever war is over because there's no more missiles, bullets, tanks, and bombs being built to go in there. But the thing is, we all pretend that that's not happening, even though we all know it's happening. And so that's, I guess, hyper-normalization. Another Adam Curtis there. But the point is, it reframes how we think about human action. Are your actions going to bring you, to keep you above Eroi greater than one, or are they going to plunge you below Eroi greater than one? And war does that. And even if you win, you lose. You know, look at like Russia in World War II. They won on the battlefield, but look at their demographic crisis. They lost 25 million people in that war, right? So we see how even though they won, it was a bit of a Pyrrhic victory, giving Russia the situation it's in now.
One of the other counters, Todd, that people would come up with, they'd say, I mean, there'd be two flavors of this, I guess. One would be, Todd, aren't you meant to be a Christian? You sound like Richard Dawkins, something like this. You sound like the four horsemen of Reddit atheism, something like this. This is science, Reddit tier scientism, they'd say. And another flavor of this, more sophisticated, you might say, maybe somebody who's read Isaiah Berlin or somebody who's read the counter enlightenment thinkers from, you know, Vico and Herder and Heidegger and so on. They'd be like, well, the trouble with this is, Todd, we're in this problem due to scientistic Baconian rationalism of this nature, right? Rationalism has brought us here. The so-called scientific enlightenment has literally led to the mass wars in and of itself. So how come you're not reproducing the problem, or how do you think in your hubris and arrogance that you're better than God or something like this, right? Some version of this argument. How do you respond? Yeah.
Well, I mean, first off, it's pretty obvious that the new atheists, much like most science popularizers, allegedly don't really apply or know anything about real science because they still seem to think that you have infinite growth, right? I mean, that they were all closely, not overtly aligned, but they were in the same like ecosystem as the sort of like transhumanists, which there's actually quite a few alt-right transhumanists too, by the way. But then with the more substantial criticism of the principle of science. So I've actually, for those who haven't seen it, they should watch my introduction to Baconism, which came out last week. Sir Francis Bacon outlines his entire philosophy in New Atlantis. And basically, the principle can be summed up simply as this. He wants to use, now it's anachronistic because machines didn't exist the way they do now in his day, but producing adepts will be reducible to an industrial process. It will no longer be an accident. So, you know, yogis, saints, prophets, sages, whatever, being able to produce ascended people will be reduced to an industrial process. That's the goal of the New Atlantis. And the fact that we haven't done that is almost entirely due to the fact of two factors. One, capitalism took over all these means of production and decides to weaponize them for warfare purposes. And then the crude materialism of the 19th century, both of which undermine completely the premise of Bacon. Bacon's premise wasn't materialistic, it was spiritual. It was to use tools and to overcome the scarcity of nature in order to elevate the soul. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I guess the critique would be Bacon set us on the path to those things that you don't like, to materialism, to kind of instrumentalist thinking, you know, to the Enlightenment, you could say, you know, owing to this, like, it just inevitably leads there because ultimately, you know, a true spiritual connection and transcendence and all those things require an almost kind of like, how can I put this? They almost require you to be what we might call a savage or a barbarian or somebody who's pre-civilized, right? And once you become civilized, once you become this sort of individual who thinks that you can get there through reason or through rationality or through scientific calculation, you've already not seen the wood for the trees. It's already over. And you basically end up here, do not pass go. How do you respond to this kind of objection?
Well, I would say that if anybody's being enlightenment, it's that person, because that's just Hume. Hume said that man has man's emotions are an elephant, and his appetites, desires, emotions, and his reason is the driver of the elephant. And the metaphor that Hume is making here is that man is fundamentally irrational. He can't really be rational. The goal then is to just, you know, not fall off the elephant, which is the exact opposite of all of the philosophical tradition up to that point in history, which was that man can be subjugated to reason. And that, see, you have this bifurcation point. So the idea of applying reason to man's life, all aspects of man's life, is often today associated with a kind of scientific thinking, maybe even utopian scientific thinking. But that's Plato. That's Aristotle. That's Seneca. That's all of these philosophers. And natural philosophy, which was just but a small portion of the overall corpus of philosophy, has grown in ways that they could not have envisioned. But it wasn't against that. All of the things that we don't like, it's capitalism. It's just capitalism. That's where it's coming from. The reign of quantity that Gonon talks about, the materialism, the satanic mills, all of that, right? And so what happened? So let's step back. Let's step back a minute. When we talk about using scientific knowledge to reduce or violence and increase agreeable or compliant behavior, let's use a single example, right? Instead of something that's as complex as international relations. You know, if you want to tranquilize a bull elephant to tag it, you know, you can get a high-powered rifle with the right amount of CCs, and it's going to go down every single time in a predictable, reasonable fashion. Then the elephant's going to wake up, maybe with a headache, and stroll across the Serengeti. You can use science to develop non-lethal systems that can just basically stop cold an aggressor, right, just by manipulating, understanding this biology. Now, granted, I'm not saying the bull elephant's an aggressor, but it's the same principle. You know, you could have a high-powered rifle firing tranquilizer at an armed gunman and take him down. Now, I mean, you know, that's not how law enforcement works, but it could work that way. And the thing is, it would be fast. I mean, once you understand, you know, 180-pound male, you know, this age, this sex, or sorry, this race, and then, you know, bam, he's down. So you can use a correct understanding of the physical world around you to achieve real-world results and disarm or disable individuals without having to use lethal force. Now, and of course, here's the thing. Humans are the point of failure. And so the importance here is understanding that even if you're the most unhinged, you know, aggressive, you know, Tamerlane building pyramids of skulls, there's still a structure in the universe that will stop you cold. And that's thermodynamics. Eventually, you're going to run out of energy and your empire is going to stop. What I'm saying is international relations isn't working properly because it's not intentionally informed by this understanding. And so if you were to talk to a potentially aggressive leader in the kind of future that I'm envisioning, you could say, well, look, you think that going to war is going to secure some resources for you, energy. Ultimately, it's going to be reduced to energy of some kind. And the question then becomes, yeah, but that's actually getting you closer to an energy sink. That's actually getting you closer to the fail state that you're trying to avoid. And so maybe we should be talking about how to meet these needs some other way. Right, that's not how it goes today. Certainly not. That's not how George W. Bush treated the Taliban in 2001. But what I'm saying is if we were to start doing this and have a ratchet effect away from where we're going, because we're going to demographic collapse. We don't need more world wars killing off the last fertile demographic. So, yeah.
I'm not, again, Todd, you have to understand this is an intellectual exercise. I am not kind of reverting to a kind of 2015 lulbut in front of your eyes here, but I think a lot of people watching this will be thinking these things, right? If Thomas Sowell was sitting here, say, right, or Jordan Peterson or somebody like that, they'd say, the trouble is, Todd, right, you're envisaging, like, you're putting a lot of trust in these technocratic experts. You're basically recreating the problem of Plato's philosopher king. And all through history, we've seen when you do this, you're creating the conditions for tyranny. You're going to take away millions of people, billions of people's freedom in the name of this higher ideal. Okay. Like you're the, you know, it's the vision of the anointed. To use a direct quote from Tom Sowell, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. In fact, what you're doing is you're gilding the cage. How do you respond to this?
Yeah, I would argue that if we look at, I'm not asking that we construct something radically different than what already is. Now, here's the problem. What actually is? Because these people are living within a framework that pretends physics doesn't affect their daily lives, that pretends civilizations rise and fall outside of an energy system. They do. It's inside of an energy system. If you want to say that, this is the same problem I have with Bakunin. Bakunin says he's a materialist, he's an anarchist, and he's like, well, look, I don't want to be compelled. I'm like, well, nature compels you. And he's like, well, yeah, but, you know, that's different. I don't want to be compelled by a boss. But, okay, if you're a materialist and nature compels you, then your boss is compelled by nature to oppress you, and he's not over and above nature. So there's no such thing as oppression. There's just these natural forces at work at all levels of society that you can't resist. Deal with it, Bakunin. And I would say the same to these guys. These physical laws exist whether you want them to or not. I'm saying we should build institutions that are in line with them to maximize our civilization's survivability rather than fight them and go the way that we know everybody who's done that before went.
So my final question then is this. What happens when you come up against the leader who is not prepared to listen to reason, right? The, let's call it Mecca Tamerlane or Saddam Hussein or whoever else. Do you then not end up recreating the neocon within this framework, you know, it's a kind of neocon with a lick of physics paint. Because, I mean, what are you going to do if he's just not willing to listen to the reason? He's not willing to be, you know, you've explained the energy sink, but the guy is irrational. The guy's mad. Okay, because, I mean, from a classical liberal point of view, right, they're always against war. Their argument is, look, it doesn't have to be like this. We could trade. We could come enmeshed in a network of trade and mutual interdependence. And this mutual interdependence will mean that we never go to war, right? This is the sorts of arguments that were made when Nixon went to China and things like this. Aren't you just recreating that at one level of remove? Like, how do you deal with the guy who's not going to play ball?
Yeah, so this is where this is more of a meta political statement rather than a, you know, fully fleshed out policy statement. I think what people are going to struggle with the most in understanding this is, again, whether it's classical liberal or like 1960s JFK liberal, it's like, well, what do you do with the people that don't play ball? What do you do with the human, the point of failure with the human? And what I'm saying is I understand that. And I'm not relying on human compliance. I'm relying on the coercive properties of the physical world that we live in. So let's see if this analogy makes it more clear. At the end of both the American Civil War and World War One, and frankly, World War II, the Confederate and German soldiers were starving. Okay, now that put them under a caloric deficit, an energy deficit, which meant that for any unit of action, they were less efficient than the Union and American soldiers because they were not on the verge of starving. And again, the breaking of their will, the breaking of their bodies in this particular case was due to hunger, due to the blockade of these countries, due to a understanding of how food affects the human body integrated into a broader strategy of blockade. And so what I'm saying is if we use that as a template, we construct energy blockades that will leave non-compliant powers unable to even move. In the same way that a man who has been hit with a tranquilizer or on the verge of starving to death can't actually do anything. The fact that he might will to do things, but it doesn't matter. The physical forces around him have been so arranged that he can't. And ultimately, that's what I'm talking about.
But, I'm just thinking about it from a pure power perspective. You end up basically with a world hegemon again, whoever's enforcing this.
Well, no, the thing is they don't have to enforce it. It already exists as the independent structure of the universe we're living in. They are aligning themselves more closely to it. That's the difference.
I'd be fascinated to see the discussion on this one. This is very interesting indeed. Todd, you're thinking so far outside the box. You're resurrecting a lot of my old libertarian ideas here in real time. And the fact that I'm thinking them means that they're still there at some point, right? But very interesting indeed. Where can people find you?
They can find me at POF Podcast on X and on YouTube. Just type in Praise of Folly Podcast.
Be really interested to see if there are people like, this guy's just Klaus Schwab again. This is the WEF talking, Todd.
No. You see, I'm not constructing a financial system. This system already exists. I'm just using it.
As I mentioned at the start, my buddy Eric Kaufman has a new course available at the University of Buckingham. I'm going to play the video. And you, Todd, I'll see you next time. And you at home, I'll see you next time.
The ideology of our universities and many other institutions can accurately be described as woke. Woke is not an epithet, but used properly describes the dominant cultural left belief system of Western institutions. Have you ever wondered how woke came about, who believes in it, and why? Or how the culture war between woke and anti-woke forces is redefining society and politics? Well, there's good news. I've developed a 15-week online course on woke at the University of Buckingham, which is open to the global public, the first of its kind in the world. The course is not assessed, but is focused instead on deepening your our understanding of woke. I offer a rigorous objective analysis of this phenomenon, similar to the way I would for fascism, communism, or any other ideology. I've studied the cultural left since the mid-1990s, and I'm ideally placed to help you understand woke. Sign up today using the attached link.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.